Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me to continue our recap of the Matt chapters in Knife of Dreams is Spencer.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Like Andrew said, we're going to finish up our discussion on the Matt chapters, which will go through Chapter 11 of Knife of Dreams. Just to reiterate, the Fourth Age podcast will discuss all of the books in the Wheel of Time series. So if you haven't finished all of them, it is strongly suggested that you hold off on listening to this podcast until you have, so that you don't get spoiled. With that in mind, we're going to pick it up right where we left off with Chapter 10.
Village in Shiota. The next day, the day after the incident with the Edom on the Aes Sedai, Matt rides Pips next to Tuon, and Seleucia is with them on her new horse. Matt sees ravens fly by and tells Tuon that they could be spies for the Dark One. Tuon wonders how many other children's tale Matt believes, like, if you sleep on Old Hobbs Hill under a full moon, the snakes will give you true answers to three questions, or that the foxes steal people's skins and take nourishment from food so you can starve to death while eating your fill. Matt is startled at these references to the Aelfin and Elfin. Old Hob, which is Cassian Hob, was a name for the Dark One in Shandali, where Arthur Hawkwing was born. Matt recalls Satali Aniganan telling him Tuon was trained from birth in leadership and intrigue. He cannot figure out what she wants with him. They come to an odd-looking village and see a peddler driving his wagon through. Matt recognizes the houses as ancient Shiotan construction. The village starts to sink into the ground. The peddler and his horse scream as they sink as well. Matt starts towards the peddler, but Tuon and Seleucia stop him, asking what he can do. Matt thinks that his bow is ready, but he doesn't have any arrows that are ready yet. The nicest thing he could have thought to have done was to kill the peddler before he sinks into the ground. Soon nothing is left but the road. Teslin, Edesina, Jolene, and her warders, Belric and Fenn, examine the area but find nothing. The show folk are too scared to continue. They all want to turn back to Ibudar or go to Lugard through country roads, but Luca argues that they should continue to Lugard, even though most want to go elsewhere. Tom, Julian, Amatheria, Noel, and Olver join Matt, and Tom bets Matt that Luca will convince the circus to continue to Lugard in their chosen path, and Tom wins. Luca and Litali lead the troop forward at a gallop. Tuon says that the dead walking is a sign of Tarmogoyon. That evening, when Lopin and Narum serve dinner, no one eats much, and Matt sends them to join Harnan and the Red Arms to get good and drunk. And that's an order. Dom and Aniganan invite Julian and Amatheria to their tent for a drink. Aniganan is trying to bring Amatheria out of her shell and her fear of the Shanshan. They are all changing and becoming more accepting. Tom reads his letter from Moraine, and Matt finally asks him about it. The letter says Tom should show it to Matt only when he asks. She writes that she will confront Lanfear shortly, but she will not be dead. Tom and Matt and one other must try to rescue her. Matt knows the way. She wishes the best for Lan and Nynaeve. She says to remember the game of snakes and foxes. Matt is not sure because he saw the twisted red doorway melt. Olver says Brigitte told him that the Tower of Genji is the way to the Aelfin and Elfin. You'd have to draw the snakes and foxes sign on it with a bronze knife to open up a door. Null says that Jane Farstrider thought it was on the Shadow Coast. He describes it to Matt, but Matt recognizes it and says that he saw the tower after she fleeing from Shadar Logoth, and that Doman can lead them there. He warns them that the Aelfin and Aelfin know what is in his mind and tells them his whole story of his history. He even has to show them the scar he got from his hanging. Noel offers to be their third person. Matt agrees to go, and the final set of dice in his head stop.
Dun dun dun.
The first and most interesting part to me of this is that Tuan practically recounted perfectly who the Finns are and what they do. But she believes it to be nothing more than a children's tale. Same with the ravens and the crows and rats as spies. We know that these are all true, but why are they believed to be fables? What has been happening over in Shandar to twist these truths into fables? I mean, obviously we have Ishmael, but it just doesn't seem like his style to convince people that such things are children's stories.
Well, I mean, we've seen what he's capable of, and I could very well actually see the Imperial Sigil of the Shanshan not being the Ravens prior to Ishmael showing up. And part of the fact that they do have, you know, a bird which is connected to the Dark One as their Imperial Sigil seems to kind of show a weird sort of influence. And if it, you know, at some point in time the person in power, you know, starts explaining that, oh, you know, all these tales that we have been told, you know, that, you know, that the Dark One spies on us using rats, those are just, you know, tales to keep, you know, children believing that they need to be good at all times, because there are always crows or ravens around. And, you know, I could see it happening, and I could see it taking quite a long time to convince them that that is what, or that is the way of things. What I really love about that is that Tuan has this amazing ability to throw stuff out. I mean, a lot of times we know she's fishing for information. You know, she's looking to see, she tests Matt on his knowledge of Hawkwing to see if, you know, he might be the man who remembers Hawkwing's face or something like that. But at the same time, she'll also randomly pitch out these things that so apply to Matt, particularly like this comment about the snakes and the foxes. And, you know, you kind of have to wonder how much of a coincidence is that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff that can't be counted as coincidence, especially around the three boys, because they are Ta'veren, and so they're twisting the patterns into themselves. But it happens so often, though, that we do gloss over some of the ones that are coincidence. But I'm not sure if this one is or isn't. It's kind of hard to differentiate at times.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to tell. One of the other big things in this chapter was just how thoroughly creepy this instance of coming into contact with the dead is. Because in this particular instance, we see that it's not just like a non-corporeal manifestation of a spirit. This entire village from Shiota could, in fact, affect things around it. Maybe not intentionally, but, you know, what happened to that particular cart driver and his horse? I mean, were they just absorbed into the earth? Were they drug into some sort of weird underworldish place? You know, how is it that they were affected by this? But it was just, you know, honestly, it was one of your creepier moments, because, you know, suddenly, you know, Matt's like, wait a minute, those buildings, those can't be right. And yeah, just that idea that you're wishing he just had the arrow to be able to put the man out of his misery before, you know, he got pulled completely into the ground.
Yeah, and we know that it's more realistic than the others, because most of the other ghosts and the dead walking have been, like you said, corporeal. It's not solid. You can kind of pass through it. But this one, the horses, it specifically says that the horse's shoes rang on the paving stones. So we know that the paving stones were actually there. The horse was walking on there, and that's what finally caught Matt's attention, to get him to pay attention to this city that shouldn't be here. Is there's paving stones? This road hasn't been paved, and then it dawns on him, and he's like, oh, get the heck out of there.
Yeah, I also like how quick Tuan and Seleucia are to keep Matt back, because, you know, honestly, Matt Bloody Cawthon isn't a bloody hero, but Lord knows if he had his way, he'd try to dash forward and save that guy.
Yeah. And it also interests me, after the village has gone into the ground along with the unfortunate peddler, the Aes Sedai go to investigate the meadow. Why? What in the world are they supposed to accomplish by this? I mean, I guess they could just be trying to show the show folk that there's nothing more there, it's not as bad, or that we have perfect composure, we can do whatever we need to, even in the most frightening circumstances, but what in the world do they hope to find by walking out into the middle of a meadow? Maybe they do a delving or something? I don't know. I guess I'll never understand Aes Sedai, but still.
I think there's a penchant amongst Aes Sedai for studying things with the power. I mean, even if they're not brown. You know, it seems like whenever something happens that is outside of the realm of normal experience, the Aes Sedai immediately rush in and is like, okay, we have to check and make sure nothing was done with the One Power. You know, because if we can determine that, then you know, we've got a handle on the situation. And, you know, it's that just that kind of supernatural CSI almost that seems to take place. And I think about, you know, there were people wondering when they used the Bowl of the Winds. There were people wondering, or Aes Sedai wondering about events when they cleansed the shore or the source. And of course, they've come to the conclusion that that was some terrible forsaken weapon. You know, why test it on Shadar Logoth? And, you know, it's just the idea that they still think of themselves as such a knowing and scholarly institution that the Aes Sedai just seem compelled to investigate whenever anything weird actually takes place.
Yeah, and it seems kind of common in all of Randland is they kind of grown used to the channelers and the fact that there is channeling, and so they can't accept that anything else could cause this. I mean, early in the books, when the pattern is first starting to wig out and there's bubbles of evil or whatever you call them, the immediate thought was someone's attacking us with the One Power. Something bad is happening. And even when you, after the tower splits and you're in Saladar and one of these bubbles comes through, they immediately start forming circles to protect themselves against the Forsaken. Even though they had been warned already, there are things going on that don't have anything to do with the power. The One Power. There are powers at work here that aren't the One Power that we don't comprehend. But they can't let anyone know that they don't comprehend it, even themselves. They refuse to admit it.
Of course, another great moment is finally the revelation, Moraine's alive! Yes, I kind of remember when we first read and, you know, Moraine first went into the doorway with Lanfear, and you know, I was just kind of stunned because suddenly one of our main characters is dead, and, you know, honestly, one of my preferred characters amongst the Aes Sedai. I mean, I always really liked Moraine, and, because I guess you're supposed to, of course, but, you know, slowly we get these clues that maybe she's not as dead as people think, and it was just really, really nice to get that direct confirmation here. You know, we finally get that concept of, you know, the when Matt's reading the letter, you can almost hear Moraine's voice in one of those classic movie things where someone's reading a letter, but the person who wrote the letter is the one doing the voiceover for it. And it just, you know, it was totally one of those scenes for me.
Yeah, I read it in the Moraine voice. But I gotta be perfectly honest, when I first read the series, I was, I guess, still too immature, because for me, in book series, especially in fantasy, your main characters don't die. It just doesn't happen. They survive to the end of the series. And so even though Moraine had gone through the doorway and Lan's bond was moved, and everyone in the book assumed she was dead, I was like, no, she's not. That just doesn't happen. But then, you know, I was lucky, though, because I started reading about the same time that Knife of Dreams came out, so I didn't have to wait for the several years for it to come out for me to find out that Moraine was still alive, so.
I couldn't help throwing this in right at the beginning of the letter. My dearest Tom. Insert the cliche again. Immature. Tom Emmerich, sitting in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
I know the face of the man I will marry better than any of you could ever. Just like, Methinks thou dost protest too much, yon Aes Sedai.
Oh, most definitely thou dost. It's kind of interesting. There's lots of little things in this letter. But I really kind of picked out the, how does she know her future? She says, how can I know that that secret belongs to others? And, you know, it didn't dawn on me the first time I read it, but in subsequent rereads, I kind of figured out, oh yeah, she went into Ruhidian, she went through the rings that we know show the various paths that the future can take, based on what Avienda has talked about in previous books.
Yeah, and particularly you're given clues in the letter itself. I am not dead, and it may be that I shall live to my appointed years. It also may be that you and Matt Cawthon and another, a man I do not know, will try to rescue me. May I say, because it may be that you will not or cannot, or because Matt may refuse. He does not hold me in the affection you seem to, and he has his reasons, which he no doubt thinks are good. If you try, it must be only you and Matt and one other. More will mean death for all. Fewer will mean death for all. Even if you come only with Matt and one other, death may also come. I have seen you try and die, one, two, or all three. I have seen myself die in the attempt. I have seen all of us live and die as captives. You know, it is that idea that she has seen all of these different variations of what happens, and when it's described, those testing rings in Iridian do seem to replay multiple variations of the person's future.
Yeah, the rings and the columns are like polar opposites. The one shows you all the variations of the future. The other shows you the lives of your ancestors going backwards in time. But it's really interesting that she specifically says, you and Matt and one other, a man I do not know. Now, I'm not sure if she's being literal there or if it's just the way that she saw it, but that seems to say to me that Ulver can't have anything to do with this, because you must bring you and Matt and one other, no one else. But common theory is that somehow Noel is going to get bumped out and Ulver's going to take his place just because Ulver's so much better with snakes and foxes. I don't know.
The thing is there have been a number of theories that Noel will come out as being Jane Varstrider and sacrifice himself in order for them to escape, but that they would still need a third party member in order to fully enact their escape, thereby allowing Ulver to step in and claim his future glory, which was kind of hinted at by RJ, saying that, you know, no, Ulver is indeed not Gidle Kane. You know, he wasn't meant to be a red herring. He has a destiny of his own.
Well, he's already been rather instrumental just in the telling, hey, I know how you reach the Finns because I've been told by Brigitte. But, I don't know, it seems really too specific for me to allow for even the give and take of Ulver in the equation. And also, it's kind of interesting here, I had to throw in the fact that Matt is pretty sure that the Finn will know that he's coming, that they're in his head. And then all the prophecies that we have about giving up half the light of the world to save the world, or Matt getting rid of an eye, or whatever, all these other visions and dreams and etc., where Matt has one eye outside of his skull for various different reasons. And there's as many theories on this.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I always kind of wanted to see the grand gesture by Matt. The him becoming so fed up with the Finns that in the bargaining attempt to get Moraine free, he willingly removes his own eye just to kind of prove a point to the Finns and kind of say, well, you want to see through my eyes? Well, here, take one. And, you know, just that kind of really forceful thing. Because, I mean, it's just that idea that he offered. The idea is that he gives up half the light of the world. You know, he offers it freely. And, you know, yeah, obviously there's been discussion back and forth. Well, does he lose an eye? Doesn't he? You know, dreams and visions and foretellings and, you know, all sorts of different things seem to indicate that Matt's going to, in some way, lose an eye. And, you know, here we have that entire concept that, you know, even the Aelfin have told him, you know, you must give up or half of the light of the world to save the world. And it's just kind of that idea that, you know, well, how do you lose half the light in the world? So, I don't know. We will hopefully be coming upon an answer to that question very, very soon.
We hope. But I don't think that Matt is as yet as mentally unstable as would be necessary to pluck out one of his own eyes. I could see him willingly submitting to their removal of one of his eyes if he thought that it was important enough, but I don't think he could pluck it out himself. But, yeah, it's really cool. We're talking about the Tower of Genji. It's something that RJ put in the Eye of the World, and it has maybe a sentence or two, maybe as much as a paragraph, I don't recall. But it's the first book in this series of Infinite, it seems like. How long? He's been planning this forever, since the beginning. Either that, or he added these things in case he could do them later, but wasn't really sure, and he's like, oh, good, I can do this, or, oh, great, now I can do that. But that doesn't seem the way that he would do it to me. Since the beginning, he was planning to have Moraine die, and Matt have to go to this tower of, or Moraine get captured by the Finns, and Matt have to go to the Tower of Genji, which he saw in the first book, to get her back.
Yeah, the first time we see the Tower of Genji is in Chapter 24 of the Eye of the World. Another time when the eastward shore had become flat grassland again, broken only occasionally by thickets, the sun glinted off something in the distance. What can that be? Rand wondered aloud. It looks like metal. Captain Doman was walking by, and he paused, squinting, toward the glint. It do be metal, he said. His words still ran together, but Rand had come to understand without having to puzzle it out. A tower of metal. They've seen it up close, and I know. River traders use it as a marker. We be 10 days from White Bridge at the rate we go. A metal tower, Rand said, and Matt, sitting cross-legged with his back against a barrel, roused from his brooding to listen. The captain nodded. Aye, shining steel. By the look of it, or look and feel of it, but no a spot of rust. 200 feet high it be, and big around as a house, with no mark on it, and never an opening to be found. I bet there's treasure inside, Matt said. And it continues from there. And that's just, you know, it is. It's one of those great things to see that, you know, proves that Robert Jordan doesn't put anything in the books without some sort of meaning, because, I mean, it comes back in The Shadow Rising when Perrin follows Slayer to it and Birgit stops him from touching the tower, and then, you know, finally reappears again in Knife of Dreams and will be forthcoming in the rescue attempt for Moraine.
Yeah. I really want to hit this point. After the village is sunk and the show folk are all saying, oh, we can't go that way, we have to go back one way or the other. And Luca, in the matter of no more than 10 minutes, has them all convinced that the best way to go is onward. Now, we can assume that Luca isn't using compulsion here, because Matt's medallion would have let him know if Luca had channeled. But what he does here seems to me to be similar to hypnosis. There is actually a branch of a practice called conversational hypnosis, which is a bit more sly than the stage hypnosis that the big entertainers will put on and they get paid for. But it's a simple use of certain voice patterns that produces similar to results to what we see Luca accomplish here. And in fact, it really seems to me that the high chant that we hear about, especially from Tom and other Gleeman, it really sounds to me to be a type of hypnosis. It's not storytelling. It's rather than just telling the story to the person, you're pulling the person into the story.
That's an interesting thought. I also agree. I don't think Luca is capable of channeling. I hadn't given it much thought, really. And it's partially just because Luca is such a stage person. He is such the natural performer that, you know, he even seems to, you know, perform when he walks up to sit down and, you know, take his evening meal. You know, he always loves being the center of attention, and he is such a show must go on, you know, center ring, bright spotlight type of personality. But I do like that concept of the high chant using rhythmic and vocal patterns in such a way that the person is drawn in and they experience the sensation more deeply. I do really like that idea. Having done an amount of storytelling myself, I think that's kind of your ultimate goal of a person who sets out to tell a tale in that way, is to draw people in. And in some ways, it's what Robert Jordan intends to do through the written work, is to draw us in. And, you know, I wonder if he had that particular idea in mind when he developed the concept of the various ways you speak, because Tom does mention, you know, that there are differences between plain speech or common speech, and then plain chant, and then high chant, and, you know, even going back to the true and unadulterated old tongue.
Yeah, that is the fundamental purpose for storytelling, is to, and now I've finally thought of the word, is to give the listener or the reader an experience, to have them experience the story, rather than just hearing it and listening to it, to have them actually experience it. And Tom is a master of this, and that's how he could, and that's the only reason he made the bet with Matt. He even says that he keeps the gold mark as a memento to remind him that even the luckiest man in the world can lose. But Tom being a master at his craft, I don't think that Luca is a master at the same craft. I don't think he uses it in the same way, because he's not telling a story. He's actually trying to get them to experience a more heightened experience than the one that they're attending. Like in the show, there's animals, there's crazy things that you can go and see and watch, and that's an experience in and of itself. But the addition of whatever it is that Luca's doing creates an even stronger experience.
This, of course, brings us to our final chapter of the episode. Chapter 11, A Hell in Matarin. Lucas Circus leaves early the next morning. They pass merchants and tinkers going south. By mid-morning, they reach the town of Matarin. Tom and Julian go in to scout. Seleucia summons Matt to Tuon, where she is talking with Satellanon. Tuon wants to visit a hell, which is a common term for a low kind of tavern, which is known specifically for its seedy atmosphere, including violent outbreaks of fighting and crime. Tom shows up, directed by Harnan, and reports that there are no Shanshan in Matarin. Tom says that he knows of a suitable place for Matt to take Tuon. It is called the White Ring. It's actually supposed to be an upscale establishment, but Tuan being of, you know, royal difference, it is assumed that she will not know. But Tuan being of royal bearing is presumed not to be able to tell the difference. Matt, Tom, Tuan, and Seleucia head through the circus toward the town. The town people watch Mioria's leopards, Littell's bears, and Balat and Abar eating fire. Kilar, one of the guards at the town gate, tells them that the Shanshan said they should guard this town better. Tom leads them to the White Ring, an average inn. Mistress Heelan, the innkeeper, greets them and tells the serving maid Jera to bring their best Kiranali wine. Tuan, of course, orders ale. She asks Matt about courts, but he knows more of Aeron and Shiota than Camelin and Tyr and Shinar. They both know Abudar. Tuan asks about gambling, so they join in, at a dicing table with three Altaran merchants and a Tarabiner merchant. Matt watches the game and recognizes it as Piri Match, a game popular 1,000 years before Archer Hawkwing. One of the Altaran merchants gets up and leaves very suddenly, and after the group returns to the table, Tom returns with news that the Golem has killed Endurador. Matt recalls he can fight it with the Foxhead Medallion. There's also a Shanshan army on the border of Murundi. They take anyone passing through and make them drink an herbal tea, which is, of course, fork root. The Soldam then collar anyone who gets wobbly from its effects. Tom also brings in information that they are looking for a Tuan imposter. Tom and Matt begin to plan their departure from Lucas Circus. They decide they will take Vannon and the Red Arms as well as Aludra. Matt wants to head east if Vannon knows a pass through the mountains. When Tuan and Seleucia return to the table, Matt and Tom hustle them out of the inn. Tuan thinks that the plot may be engineered by her sisters, Ravashi or Shimal. Matt, of course, promises to get her to safety. Suddenly, several approaching men pull swords and begin to attack. Together, the group manages to kill all of the attackers. Tuan kills only one woman. Matt recognizes one of the men attacking as Vane. Out of nowhere, Tom apologizes for seeing things that cannot be, and Seleucia nods. Having killed a local merchant, Matt realizes that they have to leave Lucas Circus immediately. One of the great things I loved about this chapter was how much Tuan kind of complains that, you know, this isn't, you know, like the, you know, it isn't anything like what I heard about, and she kind of eggs him on and pushes him when he's dicing to try to, like, get him to get into hot water, and it actually seems to be a welcome diversion when the people attack them outside of the inn. It seems to be more like what she's actually looking for in an experience.
Yeah, she's, I think she knows full well how sheltered she's been, and so she's kind of really, a lot of it is she wants to see her toy, she wants to see Matt actually in a fight and see how good of a fighter he is or isn't, but I think also she knows how sheltered she's been, and she kind of wants to escape that. She wants to experience the low parts of life and understand how other people live. If not the common people, then especially those people who are the exact opposite of what she is, which I think is common for human nature. You want to see, you want to understand, you want to kind of be the exact opposite of what you are.
It was, of course, nice to see Siroth, actually, you know, Semirog's plot to draw Tuan out and have her disposed of show back up after being mentioned in the prologue. It was just one of those neat little moments wherein, you know, they're looking for someone impersonating Tuan. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah. That's why it's always dangerous to have, you know, dark friends that have power, because then they can, especially with the kind of government system that the Seanchan have, if someone is ahead, far enough ahead of you in power and authority, then what they say is truth, and you cannot argue against it. That's just the way life is, and you deal with it. I had to throw this in here, and I added this just to advance my own plot. It's said, Tom says it to Matt, when he's been searching and spying around the places that are taken over by the Seanchan. In these places, few among the common people seem to resent them, seem to resent the Seanchan. I mean, the nobles do, because they've been taken out of power, and those who have had a relative collar do. But for the most part, the common people, they respect and admire them, because they've made life better. That's specifically for Virginia.
All right, you're taking pot shots while you can.
When the producer's away, the editors will play. Wah-ha-ha-ha.
I also had to laugh at one of the other notes that you had made. She made one of those odd gestures for warding off evil by folding the two middle fingers and extending the other two stiffly. Rock on!
Is there any other way to interpret that? Rock on.
I have seen a few drawings of, you know, wizards or spellcasters making various gestures, and I have seen the pinky and forefinger extended, rest of them curled position, but it was just one of those moments where I was kind of like, you know, oh yeah, that is kind of the yeah, rocket.
Well, depending on the way they've turned their wrist, it's either rock on or it's the Spider-Man shooting out his web. I don't know.
I don't want to even think about Tuan having Spidey powers.
Anyway, okay, let's get back to some relevant conversation here. We know that the, quoting from the book, how is it that it, the Golem, found out that he, Matt, was with Lucas Cho? How is it tracking Matt? Or is it tracking Matt, or is it tracking the show? It could be receiving information from a dark friend in the show, or even someone in Matt's entourage, for which I submit Jolene. But it's also possible that it's following Noel. We know that he still has residual stuff from his time with Ishii in there. But there are several possibilities, and unless it's someone who is with the show, or it's tracking the show, then it's still going to be following Matt after he leaves the menagerie.
That's true. I mean, I kind of always assumed that it somehow became aware that Matt was traveling with Aes Sedai, and with the fact that they've grown less and less reticent about channeling, that it has to have some way of following it. I mean, I remember there being that earlier chapter, once all the channelers left with the Bull of the Winds, the Golem, we actually got a rare point of view from the Golem itself, and it kind of went into the concept of how it could sense the channeling, and so I kind of have to guess that that's how it was happening. But bringing up the fact that it might be able to follow Noel somehow is very interesting and at the same time very creepy.
Yeah, I have to admit I had forgotten about the point of view from the actual Golem itself and that it could sense the channeling. But it brings to mind another question, just really quickly off the top of my head. Is that the only point of view we have from a Shadow Spawn?
You know, I think it might be. I don't think we've gotten a point of view from the Murdrel, and that would just be odd. And the only one we would, if we did get one, I would think, would be from Shadowharan's point of view, unless you count Slayer amidst Shatterspawn somehow, because we have had a point of view from his perspective, but it's questionable whether you can call him Shadowspawn or not.
I don't think so. I think he's still too close to the human roots to be considered Shadowspawn. No, we never did get a point of view from Nard, did we? That's upsetting.
I tell you, it's going to come in the spin-off sequel in which Narg's widow decides to take up legal suit against Rand for damages and loss.
Although her best defense attorney has been bail-fired out of existence, so I guess he'd be the prosecuting attorney, wouldn't he?
Quite possibly.
Anyway, well, it's interesting because, you know, Matt thinks that his foxhead medallion, he specifically thinks that he knows that he can use it to fend off the golem. And most people seem to assume that it's because of the fact that it's a Terran Greal and it has to do with the One Power. But there's also this other theory that's from Scott.
Hello, my name is Scott Fires, and I was just wondering, everyone seems to think that the One Power in Matt's Terran Greal is what hurts a golem, but could it not be the silver? I mean, there's no evidence otherwise, and whether Balefire, any of the different things that the One Power is, you know, usable to. My question is, why not the silver? Robert Jordan obviously made a point of it being a silver medallion that he wears. Just your thought.
I definitely wanted to thank Scott for that particular idea. There are a number of people who do, of course, assume that it is because it is a Terran Greal. And the only reference point that we have for that actually comes from the somewhat lesser known Wheel of Time tabletop role-playing game, in which point, at one point, they are discussing various Shadowspawn in which a storyteller or game master can use as adversaries for your opponents, and the golem does show up, and amidst that section, it mentions something about having a allergic reaction to Terran Greal. That is the primary source for people suggesting that it is the Terran Greal. I have, however, also heard the theory put forward that it could be the silver in the item. The biggest issue is we've never seen the golem interact with either material, you know, be it a Terran Greal that isn't silver or silver that isn't a Terran Greal before. So I don't really know. It would be interesting if Jordan decided to use one of your classic kind of allergic reactions in there. I guess we'll probably pretty much have to read and find out, because we know we're going to find out sooner or later.
Yeah, and I'm honestly kind of hesitant about accepting the information from the role-playing game myself. Because if I remember the quote correctly, the amount of input that RJ had into that was to tell them, no, you may not have ninjas in my world. But that could be related to something completely different. I don't know. But it seems... but my own personal theory about this is that it's not the fact that it's Terran Greal, and it's not the fact that it's silver, but it's the fact that it disrupts the weaves. Because this Shadowspawn has to be held together by something, and it's obviously not flesh and bones. So, to me, it seems most likely that what is holding them together is the One Power. Or maybe the true power, but we don't know whether or not Matt's medallion has the ability to block it. But it seems to me like the reaction that the creature has is because of the fact that the Terran Greal is disrupting the weaves that basically are its being. Its blood and life or whatever it is that causes it to tick is the One Power, and this Angreal coming in contact with it is interrupting that, and so it has a reaction.
It was an interesting point that I had noted when the group attacks Matt, they kind of make this point about being attacked by a number of men. And then at the very, very end... where is that? I just lost it again. And then Miracle of Miracles, bleeding profusely, but his blood too hot to let him feel the full pain yet. He was facing the last, one he had not noticed before. She was slim, or young and slim, in a ragged dress, that, or she might have been pretty had her face been clean, had her teeth not been showing a rictus snarl. The dagger she was tossing from hand to hand had a double-edged blade, twice the length of her hand, or of his hand. And it just always kind of occurred to me, when we got descriptions of Greymen early in the books, it was mentioned that there were women Greymen as well. And it seemed odd to me that they're facing down this entire group of people that they assumed were men, and then suddenly there's this one woman who's facing off against Matt. And we know the group has been sent to kill Matt. I mean, this is that entire order that the Forsaken now have been given reins and license and even, impetus to get rid of Matt and Perrin. And I didn't quite wonder if maybe the group was supposed to help conceal the approach of the Gray Man, that being a woman in this particular case, and that's where that came from. Now, I have no proof. It doesn't say that she was really ordinary or anything. It's just that she went completely unnoticed up until that point in the battle. And I had always wondered about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had never thought of it that way. It does make sense. Except, I think most Gray Men, even the fact that she was the last one standing, I don't think would have been that much. I don't think that a Gray Man or Gray Woman would have called as much attention to herself as she did with the way she acted there at the end. But that's just my own personal opinion. But, you brought up that the orders to kill Matt and Perrin come from the Forsaken, and from we know that they originated with Morden. But I want to know who gave them to this specific group. We know that someone is working in Altera, so most likely it is Semerong, but really it could be any of them. But what's also interesting to me is, how is there a dozen Dark Friends in one place? Because I maintain that there's a really small population of Dark Friends in the world. We've been focusing on them, and this one and that one, and they're attacking everywhere, so we like to see that there's a whole lot, but I really don't think that there are. Unless, the number has started to go up recently with the Dark One's touch on the world, then the people are being afraid of this force that they can't see and they can't fight against that is wrecking their world. Because, the Dark One's touch is much more present to these people than the Dragon Reborn is.
True. And I do agree. I think that the population of Dark Friends is a lot lesser than we might believe it to be. My primary evidence for that is the one particular Dark Friend. I don't remember her name now, but she shows up and tries to kill Matt and Rand in Eye of the World, and then Matt sees her again in Abu Dhar, I want to say, and then she was back in Camelin, and I think that's finally where we've seen the last of her so far. But I mean, she's back and forth and back and forth, the fox-faced Dark Friend, and her name is just totally escaping me at the moment. So it's kind of like that, we see a few of them here and there. And, even the Dark Friend social that we saw earlier in The Great Hunt, there were only a few dozen of them in the room, and you would think that any sort of massive, we want you all to be on the lookout for these three boys, would encompass a lot more, a convention hall type size people, if there were that many.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Because if you think about it, most of the people in Ranland are common people. They live on their farms with their families, and they go out in the mornings, and they take care of their livestock. They plow their fields or irrigate or harvest or whatever season it is right there. And so they really don't have any incentive to become a Dark Friend. But those people that do have incentive are people that are specialized in one thing or another. And so the ranks of the Dark Friends are really strong because they have strong individuals who... But the numbers aren't that great. They aren't strong in numbers, they're strong in prowess, I think is kind of what I'm getting at. Which is why they reused the Dark Friends where they're needed most rather than just have them sit in their place and wait there. Like you said, there's one lady whose name we can't remember. They move her from one end of the land to the other end of the continent and back again, and it's interesting.
Her name is Millie Skein, originally, if I remember properly. She goes under the name of Lady Xiain. Hate some of these names. But she tries to kill Rand and Matt in a village near Camelin. She is spotted by Matt at a racetrack near the Chelsain Palace. She leads a circle and reports to Carradine. Is frozen in place while Samael pays a visit. Carradine orders her to kidnap Matt. On Moradin's order, she goes to Camelin. He gives her Falion and Marilyn. David Hanlon reports to her, and she executes Joachim Carradine. She keeps Falion as a servant. She does a whole lot.
Yeah, just reading about this. At age 15, she goes to the White Tower, but she can't learn to channel, so she turns Dark Friend! That makes a whole lot of sense. But in the next 7 years, she performs 20 assassinations. That's a massive level of skill. Even back in these kind of, not really primitive, but more simplistic ways when people weren't guarding themselves as much as we do now. You have Secret Service swarming all over people and bodyguards hired by the dozen. But still, 20 assassinations in 7 years, that's an amazing amount of skill, but that's also an amazing amount of damage on a person, especially at the young age she is. That's between the ages of 15 and 22,
23. Yeah, I mean, that is amazingly impressive in a gruesome sort of way.
Yeah.
But going back to hell.
Why not? I think it's kind of interesting. We get, at the end of the fight, there's Tom's talking to Seleucia, and he says, it's basically, I'm old and I see things that cannot be. I'm an old man, Tom said suddenly, and sometimes imagine I see things that can't be. But luckily, I always forget them. Seleucia paused to look up at him coldly. Lady's maid she might be, but blood seemed not to faze her at all. And what might you be trying to forget? I can't recall, Tom replied, and Seleucia nodded and went back to examining his wounds. The thing he can't recall is obviously Seleucia fighting right next to him. We know that she's Tuon's next to last line of defense, the last line of defense being Tuon herself. So she's a capable fighter. My question is, number one, why is this supposed to be secret? And number two, how does Tom know that it's supposed to be kept secret?
I think part of that goes back to Tom's extreme level of involvement in Dostimar. I think that he is so embroiled in those sorts of secret intrigues that in his time as, you know, court bard for Morghese, that he picks up on a lot of things. And in some ways, Tom himself, acting as a court bard for a queen, might have also been similar to Seleucia being a lady's maid for Tuan. That it might have carried an undercurrent that we know Tom is very, very skilled with the daggers. That, you know, it could be that, you know, Morghese always had a court bard around for the secondary reason that you could never be too careful, particularly when the last wife that Tarangale de Modred had, you know, suddenly ended up, you know, dying. Oh no, and the daughter heir disappeared. You know, it's kind of one of those weird little things that, I don't know, maybe having an extra but unknown bodyguard could be of service.
Yeah, I guess. It's always interesting to me how absolutely observant Tom is. And like you say, he is incredibly skilled in the game of houses. I couldn't survive in that world. I'm not that observant. I don't want to be. I don't like to be. I don't have to be, which is lucky. But it's astounding, the leaps and the jumps and the intuitive guesses that are usually right that Tom makes in order to play this game properly. And then you look at the other people who think that they're playing the game, but they're completely lost. And he chooses to be a gleeman, of all things. It's, yeah, he's good.
Yeah, well, and I like the interaction, too, because in saying, you know, sometimes I imagine I see things that cannot be, but luckily I always forget them, is telling them directly out, I know your secret. And, you know, and it's just kind of that, it takes on that more menacing moment when Seleucia looks up and says, what might you be trying to forget? You know, just double implying that, yes, we know you know now, and that could be dangerous for you. And, you know, and Tom kind of has that subtle, I'll keep your secret. I can't recall. You know, it's a nice, subtle sets of interactions, and I've seen this little section of the chapter misinterpreted in a few ways, and that I think at one point I may have even forwarded an opinion that Tuan may have channeled during that particular time in order to, you know, help protect Matt or something, and that might have been what Tom had seen. But the more that I read into it, it's very obvious that, yes, it was just he picked up on the fact that no simple, like, lady-in-waiting should possibly have the level of skill in combat that Seleucia seems to have. So, you know, if I did, and I don't really recall if I did or not, if I did make that earlier assumption, I am very happy to recant it now in order to, or recall it now in order to forward that Tom is just really good at the great game.
Yeah. And you know, for a couple of old people, because they're much older than Matt and Tuan, they still did pretty good on their side. And they had the same number of people that they were fighting against as Matt did, I think. I'm pretty sure it said they both had about half a dozen on attacking them on either side. So, he may be old, he may have a gimp, but he's still one heck of a fighter.
The Gray Fox.
Boy.
Yeah, this is a horrible, horrible animated Batman reference. Ha. We have our crossover for this particular episode. It was also kind of interesting that Matt recognizes the man who leaves the fight, Vane, amidst the attackers. You know, he says to himself, or he says, his name is Vane, and I don't think anybody in this town will believe a respectable merchant attacked us in the street. Luca will give us horses to be rid of this. It was strange. The man had not lost a coin to him, had not wagered a coin, so why? Very strange indeed, and reason enough to be gone quickly. You know, it's kind of one of those things that Matt, I don't think, truly recognizes how important he is yet. And Perrin's kind of beginning to get there, but Perrin's really been on that, I really don't care what happens in the rest of the world as long as I get to achieve my goals, which, of course, in this book is getting Fael free, as it has been for so many books. But I don't think Matt's really had that moment where he comes to the point of, hey, I'm actually important enough that people are trying to kill me. So it's just kind of interesting that that's how the chapter closes out.
Yeah, it's really... So what is Perrin going to whine about now in The Gathering Storm and subsequent books?
I wish I hadn't thrown my axe away. I just want to be a blacksmith. People keep calling me Lord.
Well, that's the one thing Matt keeps whining about. I'm no bloody Lord. Well, he whines about having to be a hero, too, but he still does it. Yeah, anyway, the Merchant Vale, wasn't that one of the gentlemen that he went to play dice with, and he just kind of got stone-faced and then walked away? I'm done. Come on, we were just about to close this deal. Nope, I'm leaving. Thank you anyway. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and I think what that is that's a pretty direct sign that Vane was a dark friend, and he recognized Matt from, you know, the images of, you know, the dark friends. You know, you be on the lookout for these three youths, and you know, basically now that the order has gone out from the Forsaken that they need to die, that, you know, he kind of said, look, time to summon reinforcements.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting at that dice game, the female merchant, where was she from again? A Terrabonner merchant. There were the three Alteran merchants who were the three men, and then the Terrabonner merchant. It's always interesting to see people playing with other people's heads and assumptions. And this one, the merchant, the Alterans are assuming that she's drunk, and so they're going to get a great deal, and she's going to be stiffed or whatever it is. But it's quite the opposite. In fact, she is sober as all get out, but pretending to be as drunk as Elaine that one time. But and you see that the flash in her eyes as she's starting to worry about how Matt is winning so constantly at this game and amassing this pile of earnings. It's also interesting to me that she's the one that assumes that he's cheating. The other guys at the game just, they have bad luck, or he has really good luck, but she's contemplating, okay, is he doing something that he shouldn't be? What's going on here? There's got to be something extra, and I think that might just be because she herself is something extra, and so she's kind of looking for that in other people. I don't know. I think she's an interesting character for the few paragraphs that we see her.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that just goes to relate at the craft with which RJ is able to build his story. You know, that he can take these simple, you know, one-shot, or maybe possibly even not one-shot characters, and build, you know, a deeper interaction and a deeper level of character structure to them, even if it's just for the purpose of, you know, showing how, you know, people could always be more than they seem.
He's very good at giving you characters that you can then say, okay, here's the blanks that RJ had filled in. He's created this, and then you can go in and create your own off of that. You can fill in the other blanks around that whatever you want to assume based on your own life. And I think that's a great way of, again, immersing the reader and giving them the experience of the book, is You give them just enough information, and then you let them fill in the rest of the blanks based on their own life and their own memories and their own experiences.
I also kind of liked in this particular chapter, as they were sitting and talking, Matt takes his hat off and puts it on the table, which of course Tuan thinks is horribly bad luck, and you know, she makes the little sign to ward off evil. But, you know, Matt kind of plays it off lightly. He's like, I'll try to remember that. You know, just totally brushing off what she said. And she responds with, yeah, I have decided you will not do for a cupbearer toy. Not until you learn meekness, which I almost despair of teaching you. Perhaps I will make you a running groom instead. You are good with horses. Would you like trotting at my stirrup when I ride? The robes are much the same as for a cupbearer, but I will have yours decorated with ribbons. Pink ribbons. You know, and Matt goes on to, you know, lament over the fact that Tylan had to have told Tuan about the pink ribbons, because that's the only reason that Tuan could possibly know that a pink ribbon would have special significance to Matt.
That whole relationship was... and that's about as much as I can say for it.
Yeah. I was also interested in how Tuan seems not to be amazingly possessive of Matt. By this point, you have to believe that she is about 85 to 90% convinced that Matt is the man that she's prophesied to marry. But Matt keeps himself very in check when the young lady comes over to pour wine, and she gives him, you know, a big beaming smile with her curtsy before darting off. And Tuan then says, you know, you could have smiled back at her, Toy. You know, holding up a mug for a sniff and wrinkling her nose. She is very pretty. You were so stone-faced, you probably frightened her. And, you know, it's just one of those kind of moments where, you know, to Matt, that'd be like, whoa, wait, I could have been smiley and pleasant? Oh man, I missed it? Aw.
It just kind of points out the difference between the way that two of them are approaching this relationship. Because to Tuan, it's been foretold, it's her destiny, she has to do it. It's almost like an imperial duty, she has to do it, because it's been prophesied that she's going to marry Matt. But to Matt, he's genuinely in love with Tuan, we know that, and so he's going to remain true to her. But in Tuan's mind, we'll get into it later in the book, marriage doesn't necessarily have to do with love. It's for power and wealth and position or whatever. And so fidelity isn't really all that important, which is completely different from the mindset here in Randland.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things when Matt first finds out that he's destined to marry the daughter of the Nine Moons. You know, he's kind of grumbling to himself, you know, how he just, you know, he likes going into an inn and gambling and having a drink and, you know, having a, you know, a pretty lady or two on a knee and, you know, that kind of thing. And that's how, you know, that's how he likes things, and he doesn't want it to really change. And, you know, when you kind of really look at how well they work together and that, that's pretty much the way it could be if he wanted it. But, you know, we have kind of seen a gradual change in Matt. And, you know, he is very obviously smitten with Tuan. And, you know, who knows, by the end of it, he may end up thinking that, you know, all he really wants is to just be with Tuan and be happy. And I think that's nice, because that's... again, a kind of growing of the character in his ideals that, you know, yes, he could still have what he wanted when he was younger, but now, you know, he might not actually want that anymore.
Yeah. I love Matt as a character, because to me, of the three, in fact, of all of the Two Rivers folk, he seems to have matured the most, even including Nynaeve. I'll say it once, I'll say it again, I believe it to be true. I think he is the only one of our main characters who is not selfish. Except maybe Moraine and Lan. The rest all to me seem to be incredibly self-centered on one thing or another. But
Matt, he has grown so much as a character because he started out in the Two Rivers. He was a prankster. He loved to play jokes and have fun and have a good time with his friends. And then they leave the Two Rivers. He wants to be a city boy. He wants to have the wealth and the life and the luxury. And then he gets the knife, and that changes him for a few books. But then once he's done with that, he's trapped in Tar Valon with the Aes Sedai, and his only wish is to get the heck out of Dodge and to kind of become himself again. So he goes, he follows Ran to Tyr and then to Ruhidian, where he meets with the, where he meets the Finn for the second time and gets his head stuffed full of other people's memories. He dies. That's got to have an effect on a man. And he's just... And then he's been in two long-term relationships since that. Before he even ran away from Ebu Dar, he's become a general. He's not just a leader of his men, but his men love him, genuinely love him. They would lay down their lives for him if he asked them to. He won't, and they know he won't, but they would anyway. He has progressed so much as a character and become so different from what he was in a good way. I mean, Perrin and Rand, they've changed. They really have. But it's, in my opinion, they've both changed negatively. And Rand, not just because of his I'm stone, I'm cold, also because of his I have to bear the weight of the world, and I have to do this, and I have to do that. And Perrin is a whiny little snot. Matt, though, that's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, were I able to take my pick of people to play in the Wheel of Time, Matt would definitely be the character. I really do admire, like, every phase that he ends up going through, because it's such a wonderful range, and it does. He goes through so much and grows so much as a character that I just think it would be a wonderful experience to be able to say, yes, I was Matt Coffin.
And the experience that you would have to have, the really, in any of these, any of the parts in a movie or a TV series or however they ended up doing it, the growth that you would have to have in order to portray the character, because I do a lot of stage plays, and you have to become the person. You can't just act like that person. You have to become them. You have to understand why they are doing what they are doing, why they are saying this, why they are acting that way. And you have to portray that to the best of your ability. And so you have to grow. You have to change. You have to become that person. And the journey that you would take being any of the characters in the book, it would be absolutely amazing. I mean, there are some journeys. I would absolutely hate to be Perrin. I don't think I would ever... Well, maybe Rand. I don't know. I don't think I could be mad just because I want to be able to blow people up just by weaving some things around, but I don't know.
So it's an Ashaman's life for you, huh? So any other thoughts about a hell in Matarin?
None that is fit to air.
So I think that pretty much wraps up this particular episode. We would like to once again thank Encyclopedia Watt for providing those wonderful chapter summaries, which we base our own summaries upon. We would also like again to thank Scott for his voicemail. And if you'd like to get a hold of us, to leave us any sort of feedback, be it general comments, criticisms, crazy theories, there are always a great number of ways that you can do that. You'll, of course, give us a call and a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
You can also send us an email at podcast@dragonmount.com. Also, on dragonmount.com/podcast, you can find all the episodes that we have aired to date, and there's also, for each episode, there is a comment section, and there's always a few of us who are perusing that, and we'll chime in with our two cents every once in a while.
Dragonmount.com also has a podcast forum page on the general forums list at www.dragonmount.com/forums.
Also, the Fourth Age has a MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage. We also have a Facebook group, which is the Fourth Age Podcast, and you can follow us on Twitter, which is Fourth Age, all one word.
We, of course, love hearing from everyone, and we try to respond to everything that comes to us as soon as we're able. Of course, many of the voicemails do make it into podcasts as well, and we are just waiting on these superb efforts of gentlemen like Spencer, who do our editing, to get through the monumental amount of stuff that we actually have produced.
Yep, and you know, a big thanks to our producer Virginia, even though she couldn't be here tonight. All the work that she does for this podcast is absolutely amazing. She coordinates all our efforts and makes sure that we all have work to do when we have time to do it, and the things get done and out as soon as we can get them to you. So thanks to Virginia. Well, it was really fun talking with you tonight, Andrew, and really enjoyed these chapters. This is Spencer saying, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gelos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravya Ninto Manchima, Aishite. Actually, where's my dice bag? I actually wonder if you could actually hear this or not. I should try it. That would be an irritating sound to constantly have inside your skull. I like it better if you cup both hands and do it, but I don't think I can do that by the mic and hold the talk button down.
Elbows. Use your elbows. Or your toes.
Incidentally, pushing that button with my elbow also incidentally launched my help window and a couple other things.
Oh my.